It's time for Caffeinated Comics, a lively discussion and debate on comics, film, television, and collectibles, all fueled by the magic of Frappuccinos. Caffeinated Comics is sponsored by Chimeras Comics. Chimeras is your one stop for comic books, graphic novels, hero clicks, Magic the Gathering, and more. Explore the fantastic at Chimeras Comics. And now, here's your hosts, John and Steven.
Thank you. This is Captain of Comics. I'm your host, John Clark, and we have a very special guest in the studio today. Over the almost 2 years we've been doing this, people have constantly asked me, why do you collect? What got you into it? Why do you need to have so much? It's been joked several times on the show that my collection dwarfs even Steven's, and I have joked that I don't know why. But in the studio right now is one of my very big reasons why. My father, Gerald Clark, is here. Hi, Dad.
Hello.
How are you?
Good.
Good. We're going to move beyond monosyllables soon, I'm sure.
Maybe.
That's two. But I always joke that I use you as my cautionary example.
That's
because
right.
Because my collection is accessible.
Yes.
And we grew up in a house that one of my most vivid memories was you were a school teacher. And every summer, you would take the summer to build bookcases.
Well, not every summer.
But a few summers.
Yeah, two or three, yeah.
Okay, yeah, but I remember you spending weeks on that, and then that bookcase would be filled with books.
Yep. But there was that golden period when I had free space.
And when was that? Was there a balance?
Yeah, immediately after building it.
How long of a period was there between building the bookcase and having it be full?
Oh, it could go for months.
Really?
Sure.
Now, would you say books were your biggest collection? I mean, your game collection is also.
Yeah, it'd be a close run, both financially and even just in the number of units. But books, of course, are less expensive than games. So there were many more books. There were, I think, at the height, maybe... I was comparing it to the librarian's collection, which he still has. But I think it was 6,000 or 7,000. That's books.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing like that in games, of course. That would be way too expensive. But maybe 1,200 games.
Wow.
Yeah?
So when did you start reading? Were you an early reader? Because I know you told me that I started reading when I was around 3.
Reading
was...
Yes, but you were talking about monosyllables earlier. And that's the way you started reading. You started reading about the age of 3,
right.
But you read the stop sign. There was a stop sign outside the house, and you were still in a high chair. And so it couldn't have been much longer than when you learned to speak. You saw the stop sign, and you said, stop. I said, whoa, it's going to be a genius.
And then?
Well, then it all fell apart.
Puberty wiped the last of my potential.
But
what about you? Were you an avid reader when you were my age? Not my age, but when
no,
you were
I,
younger.
I take the spirit of your question, even if I can't answer it in a specific number of years. Somewhere around the ages of 8 or 10, I had a great ambition to be a reader. So I would walk from 127th to 116th to the library and take out whatever they allowed you to take out, maybe 3 books, and bring them home and then bring them back in a couple of weeks. But I never read them.
Well,
I just liked the idea of being a reader, I think.
Okay. And is that why... Is that why you own more books than you've read?
Well, it was an early bug, and it certainly was a virus. So, yeah, that was an early indication.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I say 1,200 books or 1,200 games or 6,000 books, you can just imagine how many were read or played.
What would you say the percentages?
Well, I'd be very happy to say... I took a count. I began to just record the title of each book I read for the last 10 years, just out of curiosity, to sort of track my curiosity. And I figure maybe on the average of 75 books a year.
That's still good.
No, it's good. It's good.
I mean, most people would struggle to read 12 a year.
Perhaps, but and they were of all sizes, some very large, some very small. But that's an average. So you would say, I think I'm up to 1,200 in the last 14 or 15 years. Doesn't mean much just to count the books you've read. But it's, in fact, it's kind of an indication how much I remember of what I've read. I've heard other people say that they were halfway through a book before they realized they had already read it.
Yeah, I'm starting to have that now.
Yeah, that's a very nagging question. Why bother then if you don't even remember that you had read it?
Right, I guess there's the sensation of actually reading it for the first time, but I've been having that with comic books. I've been recollecting comics that I had in my childhood and then trying to fill the holes of where I had missed them and then read these runs that I had never read, and I can never remember where to start because I can never remember if I'm just remembering the picture of the cover or if I've read it before. And I am having that where I've gotten 8 or 10 pages into a book and think, this seems awfully familiar. But then again, it could just be the genre, could be a riff on a story that's happened before, or it could be that I've read it. Maybe I've read it and never finished it.
Well, we may just be asking the wrong question, such as how many books can I read in a year or in a lifetime? Or perhaps closer to a valuable question is to ask, as I just did, why bother?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, you said earlier, you suggested that it might be just the experience. You said the experience of reading it for the first time. Well, it might also apply to reading it a second time, even if you had forgotten that you did read it once. There's something going on when you read a book. And we can say that whether it's a comic book or a full-length a traditional book or playing a game, there's something going on when you're doing that. And sometimes you can think about that experience as you do it. What's happening when I'm reading this book that isn't happening when I'm walking alone, that's kind of happening when I'm talking to somebody?
And is that the dialogue between you and an author?
Yeah, and perhaps a third base as well, between you, the author, and the topic that you're discussing. There's something there that's, I suppose, I guess you could say it's ennobling. Don't you agree?
Yeah, I think so. It's one way, in a way that that this conversation isn't, because when you're reading a book, you can form opinions, but you can't respond to the author directly.
Well, no, not so that he's aware of it, unless you stalk him.
I find him on Twitter, which people do to George R. R. Martin all the time.
But we react to what we read all the time. I remember one of the best books I read. I was so annoyed with it as I read it that I threw it up against the wall.
What was it?
It's the only book I think I've ever thrown up against the wall.
What book was it?
It's called Virtue's Splendor.
What is it?
Well, the title is pretty accurate. It's about the splendor of virtue.
Is it an essay or is...
No, well, it's a...
Was it a novel?
No. It's nonfiction. And it's an examination of the traditional view of virtue. That is Aristotle's and Thomas Aquinas's.
Mm-hmm. Why did that make you mad?
Well, that's the amusing part. It was so good. It was so right that... It just, I get stirred up the devil in me. But I was just so enthralled by the logic, the simplicity of this view of virtue, that I rose up in rebellion.
You rose up against virtue?
I did, yeah. Out of admiration for it.
It's almost a self-esteem issue.
Oh, no, I don't think that had anything to do with it. I, I think it was just a rebellion against common sense.
Well, when you started reading young, I know as I grew up, you were very into history and philosophy and mainly nonfiction. What did you start? Those are pretty deep for a younger reader. What were the genres that drew you in and who the authors that drew you in?
Not that. History. Especially the heroes, the heroic history, the history of heroes. I was just thinking of that the other day, too. So, as everybody in the family knows, I'm a big fan of Abraham Lincoln.
You're way into Lincoln. You're into Lincoln like I'm into Batman.
Yes, and I think if we just, it's called semantic ascent. If we just go up a level in generality, then we can see that we're meeting, mm-hmm. that Batman and Abe would be in the same room. And again, because they're virtuous characters,
mm-hmm.
and they are examples, exemplars, they would say, right, of particular virtues. Abraham Lincoln, a whole spate of them. You'll have to fill me in on Batman's.
Well, you've read and seen some Batman.
Yeah, I know, and I'm not being snide.
No, I remember you read The Dark Knight Returns after I'd gotten it in high school.
The graphic novel?
The graphic novel, okay, yeah. Right. Yeah, the one where Batman's older. And then we saw, I think you've seen most of the films. I feel like we saw one of the Christopher Nolan films together. I think we saw Batman Begins
yeah,
together.
Yeah, now that's what I mean, especially these... These variations of the young Batman.
Mm-hmm.
I was looking at a Batman film the other day. I forget who's the star.
Christian Bale did the last three, was it?
Yeah,
if it was
probably.
The recent ones.
That's who it is. And he's in a debilitated state.
Oh, that was the last one, Dark Knight Rises.
Right, and Michael Caine is the
Alfred.
Butler.
Yeah.
And as I say, he's in a diminished state physically and mentally, and that's a good working of the theme. That's what I mean, because we're still looking at the heroic. I didn't get to the end of the film, but I'm sure he lives up to the heroic image by the end of it. Is mm-hmm. that right?
Yeah, I have it. If you want to watch it,
yeah,
later
I,
today.
I don't dislike it. In fact, sometimes you remember we saw such a film in your genre. If not that one, if not, maybe it was a Batman film. And I always say at the end of each film, oh, that was better than I expected.
Yeah, I remember you really loved Iron Man.
Yeah, and then I forgot about it entirely.
Yeah, it's too bad, because I remember when you saw it, I asked you what you think of it, and you said, I can't imagine a person who wouldn't like it.
Yeah, right, and, that sounds right.
Yeah, and you should definitely see The Avengers. The Avengers is good on that level.
Yeah, but you see, now we're going to hit the same wall again. I perhaps remember saying that about the film, that mm-hmm. Who wouldn't like it, but I can't remember anything about it.
Yeah.
Now, that's not unlike what we were speaking about earlier, reading books and forgetting you had read them. So we're going for something other than a synopsis. We're going for something other than the right to say, I've read this.
Right.
I mean, that's in your teens, that's how many of us start reading really heavy literature, just to give us the right to say we read it.
Yeah, I remember being very proud in high school reading Kerouac, because I read Kerouac.
Well, you're still proud about reading The Hobbit at an early age.
Oh, yeah, I read it at 8.
Yeah,
and
that's, again, that's something that's it's not a bad motive, but it's not a high motive.
No, but when you're under 13, 14, it's all about the practice of reading. It's
yeah.
all about mastering the grammar right. and being able to physically read.
That's right.
And then once you're... Then from 15 to 25, it's all about establishing your identity, and these are the books I read, which means I'm
partly,
this kind of person.
Not all about.
I remember in my
partly.
Early 20s, I was very proud to have read all of J.D. Salinger.
Sure.
And especially books that were not Catcher in the Rye.
At that age, I was very proud to have read all of the Ian Fleming James Bond.
Right.
And at the same time, through school, having read all the Shakespeare plays.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very proud that I had that range. But that's okay when you're in your 20s, but you expect more as you get older. You expect to get something better out of it. And the closest I've been able to figure as to what that better is that just as reading itself ennobles the soul, That's what you're looking for. You're looking for the highest values you can find, and they are heroic. You're looking for validation, justification of a real hero. Now, Lincoln is a real hero. Batman is the real idea of a hero, mm-hmm. especially as we said, as I said, as you keep manipulating and molding the nuances of the suffering that he has to overcome, that makes him even more heroic. All you have to do with Lincoln is compare a photo taken in early 1862 to the last photograph taken a month before he was shot. The man looks like he's been in a coma for 4 years. He's lost so much weight.
Right.
And the eyes are just hanging there in sympathy and pain. So that would make my argument. If this audio podcast were video, then we could just show those two pictures, and the point would have been made.
Right. But well, I can put them on the Facebook page.
Well, that's great. Of course, that's the point.
You see that with most U.S. presidents. They always look like they've aged 20 years in the 4 years they're president.
Yeah, well, some...
But Lincoln especially.
Some weather. Washington, I'm sure, did well because he was just a solid guy at the beginning.
Yeah, but Washington, we only have those painted portraits. We didn't have photographic evidence we did for Lincoln.
No, but we have anecdotal evidence of his character. We have written evidence in what he says philosophically. He's a very steady guy. Mm-hmm. But Lincoln's a poet. You can just follow the maturation of his character in his writings from the age of 20 to when he died. I guess around 55. But what the war did to him. That is the suffering and the great moral strength it takes to overcome it. That's heroic. And that's why that last film about Batman fits the mold. Because we have real travail, I guess. And that's, I think, what we need. And a lot of songs to that effect, isn't it?
Yeah, well...
We All Need a Hero. What was the name of that song?
That was Bonnie Tyler.
Bonnie Tyler.
It's in Footloose. Rolling Out for a Hero. You loved that song. You loved Bonnie Tyler.
Bonnie Tyler, just great.
You loved Total Eclipse of the Heart.
Total Eclipse of the Heart. they had two versions of that.
There was a long one. It was like a Meatloaf Bat Out of Hell version.
The long one might have been 6 minutes.
Yeah, just turn around, bright eyes.
And they played it every morning at the time we were going to school. Your mother would go to the hospital, I'd go to the school, and she'd drop me off. Sometimes I'd ask her to wait a minute. She said, no. But, you know, but I've only listened to 5 minutes. There's another minute to go. Yeah, that's a terrific song.
Well, I find the best...
And it's a heartbreak. That's a great earlier one.
It's a heartbreak, right. Yeah. Well, and I've noticed most songs are... The best songs have a element of sadness to them. You know, you don't get the songs that are just happy. It seems like all the best love songs are about heartbreak.
Well, that's it, moments. You know. Who remembers the great comedic plays? Shakespeare might be an exception, but I never bought it. I read Comedy of Errors, and I read Twelfth Night.
Much Ado About Nothing.
Yeah, you know, and Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yeah.
And this is my fault, but I just don't get them, you know. It's humor is very, very different. They say it's very topical.
It's cultural.
Yeah, but I think there's a deeper reason than that. Humor is a matter of the spirit. By definition, it's and of course you know what I'm talking about. Being a comic. You can walk into a room and if the spirit is wrong.
Oh yeah. It's the one art form that can be a disaster before it even begins. If you're a band, you can just play louder.
That's right. But
David.
David, remember that time he gets up on stage? What, he's got maybe 1,000 people in the audience? And he pauses, he looks at them, He looks at them again, doesn't say anything. They're very quiet, wondering what part of the...
When is he going to begin?
The shtick this is. He says, no. And he walks off.
That story has become so apocryphal that I've heard him downplay.
It was like, well, I've seen it. I saw him do it.
The video of it?
It may have just been a, or, you know, maybe I'm falling for it. Maybe I was just listening to him tell the story.
Right.
But he may have done it, and he may have done it deliberately.
Yeah, they said he was like that. He wasn't willing to fight.
Well, you know.
If it wasn't going to go his way, he wasn't going to start.
And that's the point, you know. You walk into a room, and you can sense if the audience,
has an energy. About. Well, you've taught for, was it 35? How many years did you teach?
Well, 33, 1 year off for sabbatical.
Okay, but that's still, I mean, your classes were 25, 30
that's right.
kids. And so you, I mean, in that way, you're speaking to an audience
all
day long.
You're right. And of course, it's day after day for 9 months.
Right.
So, and you get the whole cycle over the course of the seasons. You're doing three full seasons. And they have a measure and a rhythm of their own.
And I'm sure there were days you walked into the room and you felt that there was a different energy than the day before. And
that's right. Only I couldn't do what Larry did.
No.
Just shake my head and walk out. I'd have to surrender my
pants. But rooms have an energy. It's really interesting where you think there's a linchpin to it. You think, okay, this person's controlling the room with their personal energy. But it's not like that at all. There seems to be some equation of the way everyone in the room is feeling, and it's makes the room feel a certain way.
That's right. Speaking of teaching, you could identify a personality for the class, not for the individual members and what that added up to, but the class itself, this abstract group called a class. That's what they call it in logic, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a set or a class, had a personality of its own. And class after class, that became obvious. You speak of the room that you go into as a comic.
Right.
Well, again, using this idea, semantic ascent, we just notch it up a level in general talk. We're talking now about a spirit, which is directly related to what I meant about reading. You're ennobling something. You're ennobling your mind by going up. Instead of saying energy, say spirit.
Right.
We're going up to a higher level.
It really looked like you were going to bring it closer to that.
Well, that was a closer.
Yep.
That was a spirit. That's the idea. That's
still
why,
hanging on that.
That's why comedy, mm-hmm. you've got to be it totally spirit. You've got to be in the right spirit.
Right.
Whether you're writing it, you got to feel the joy for it to succeed. And the best comedy, as you know, is not the comedy that's mean-spirited or making fun of people. I mean, some comics live on that.
Right.
But that's not that's not real comedy. Real comedy is you tell a joke about a person in such a way that he can't help laughing with you.
Mm-hmm.
That's comedy, because it's joy. That's the spirit of comedy, joy. Just as the spirit of tragedy is sorrow.
Mm-hmm.
You said that the great stories had something sad about them. That's why. There's something very sad about life.
Yeah.
Nobody escapes it.
Now, speaking of comedy, growing up, you always had an interest in it. Who were your favorite comedians?
Well,
because I remember there were certain comics that seemed to ring something in you deeper than others. But if you had to prioritize,
the ones that come immediately. Well, Bob Newhart, mm-hmm. although. I may have listened to 30 minutes of his routine.
Yeah, but
Woody
you,
Allen.
But you were a big fan of Newhart shows. I remember watching them. With
yeah, you. And that's what I mean about the spirit of comedy. All his shows, his very comedic persona, is a gentle affirmation of everybody he's criticizing.
Mm-hmm.
He had in the psychiatrist show. He had Mr. Carlin. You remember Mr. Carlin?
Yeah, in the Barb Newhart show.
Yeah. This guy obviously had problems. But they loved one another. Mm-hmm. It was just, it was funny because it was joyful.
Yeah, I heard a great story about Mr. Carlin. I think his name was Jack Davis.
The character or the actor?
The actor, where he said there was such a particular rhythm about the Bob Newhart show. It took its time. He said the next time he was on another show after the Bob Newhart show went end, and he was doing
On another?
I think as a guest appearance.
Okay.
And he said he was taking so long to tell the jokes because he was worth the Newhart rhythm that at one point the director of the show went, "Anytime you're ready, Jack."
That's right.
Because it was all about. It was all about that slowly sinking in of the situation.
That's right. And which goes hand in hand with the gentility, mm-hmm. The kindness.
Yeah, it's like Father Ted, which is a show I love. Father Ted, the Irish show about the priests, the worst priests in Ireland, who have to live on an island where no one else lives. I don't know if you've seen it. Mom saw it and she didn't really like it, but there was it had a Simpsons kind of cartooniness to it, but the thing I loved about it is the spirit is instead of yelling at each other, they're trying so hard to be nice to each other no matter what the situation is and to try to be positive and not explode.
Yeah, well, that's actually, in a sense, the opposite of what I mean. Mm. That's the interference, almost as it were, of the mind into this natural spirit. That is, when comedy is really clicking, mm-hmm. as I suppose the Elizabethan sort of was for A Comedy of Errors.
Right.
But for that period, for that audience, when it's really clicking, there's no effort involved.
Oh yeah, well that's when you're in the moment.
In the moment and in the spirit.
Well, you were also a very big Stephen Wright fan, I remember.
Yes, isn't he great?
Yeah, I saw him in Vegas, and he did 90 minutes.
That's hard to believe.
He was 90 minutes of Stephen Wright jokes, and he would break it up a little. He would pull out a guitar and play the guitar and tell some jokes, or he would walk over to the other side of the stage and tell some jokes. But it was 90 minutes of one-liners, and it was
But they're all like one-liners, yeah.
All of them. And, you know, so sometimes he would tell stories, but they'd be a story built on one-liners. It's almost like if each of his jokes is a Lego brick, he could build something out of the Lego bricks, but it would still be individual bricks.
Very intellectual humor.
Yeah, very
dry. And the joy that comes out of there is out of the intellect, mm-hmm. and especially the surreal surprises, the conjunctions that he puts together, the subject and a predicate doesn't fit, or a one paragraph long story where the conclusion doesn't fit the opening. All those surprises are intellectual, mm-hmm. and yet they're still joyful. Mm-hmm. It's not a really it's anything but a social joy.
No, it's intellectual.
Yeah, one person. You could never imagine Stephen Wright doing a comedic show with a partner.
Right, and that was one of the problems he had. He couldn't cross over into movies or television.
No.
Because he couldn't really interact with anyone.
Yeah, did we see him in a movie?
He did this short film with Rowan Atkinson that won an Oscar.
Really?
Called, what was it about? The Appointments of Dennis Jennings, I want to say. But it was about... he was going to an abusive therapist who was played by Rowan Atkinson,
right.
Which at that point I think was still doing the Black Adder.
Uh-huh.
And it ends up with him hunting him down with a rifle.
Oh,
so it was dark, but that's the only thing I ever really saw him do in cameos here and there.
Yeah, I kind of have a memory of him doing a serious role, not in a very serious drama, mm-hmm. but a straight role, a non-Stephen Wright role. But he's great, of course. I never was into much Carlin. I admired his brilliance. The seven, what was that? The seven
words
you can't
use. Yeah. I remember you had FM and AM in the record collection, and I eventually stole it.
That's one of his collection.
It was one of his albums.
Yeah,
FM and AM. Yeah.
Yeah. You see, he was just too angry.
He got angrier as he got older too. I think that's what drew me to him.
Yeah,
we were talking about the Grateful Dead with a friend of mine who was very much into the Grateful Dead, and I said, well, what is it about this band that makes it so wonderful? I understand that they're good musicians, but I just don't get it. And
right.
he's playing me a live song from the Grateful Dead, and I'm listening, and I said, oh, I understand what's wrong with this band. They're not angry enough for me.
It
was like, I like the Who and Elvis Costello. I said, even the Beatles had John Lennon. You had at least one angry guy.
Okay.
But I was also not into pot, which which also eliminated the Grateful Dead.
Yeah, but pot will make you much more appreciative.
Yeah, true.
You're a less demanding audience.
Yeah. Yeah, I was more into alcohol, which makes you less more demanding audience.
Yeah, alcohol. You know, alcohol is just like a killer.
Oh, absolutely. Wow, that got very quiet.
Yeah, well, you've got a problem being a podcast creator. Silence, I guess, doesn't come over well on the airwaves.
No, although when I listen back to it, the silence always seems longer.
Sure.
And when you listen back to it, I was like, that was 2 seconds. I remember being panicked that we had nothing left to say.
That's right.
Did you ever think about performing? You were a writer. I remember your novel. I read your novel, and you were a teacher for years and years. You definitely have a commanding presence. People are constantly telling me stories about you, and going, "Oh, when's your father coming? What's he gonna say?" Did you ever think about acting or performing or doing spoken word yourself?
Was that
Didn't it occur to you at all?
Never. Hmm. Never.
Interesting. I think most of the performers come from mom's side of the family.
Yes, I think
a lot
so.
Of musicians.
That's right.
A few comedians.
All my brothers are. I guess you outside the group, you would call us uptight. I remember once.
But good public speakers.
Who were they?
For the most part, were those lawyers?
Who?
We have lawyers in the family.
Oh, yeah.
We've had people that have to give public speaking. We have people that can command a room.
Well, you remember here in Chicago at what was that, the rehearsal dinner
for my wedding?
Husband's family, the groom's family throws.
Oh, yeah, the rehearsal dinner, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, we had that.
Your mother gave the speech to the crowd.
Yeah.
And you said, why aren't you doing that? You're a teacher. You speak in front.
I still want to know.
Well, that's the answer, because I'm not a public speaker.
Well, but you're speaking in public. Is it because you want to be able to control that environment? As we said, the spirit of the room, you want to be able to assess the spirit of a room before you...
That is one cynical way of looking at it. I guess you could say that, if you wanted to be mean. No, that's where the third base comes in. Uh-huh. You see, as a teacher, to the outsider, especially to effective teachers who play a role, and there are many who are great at doing it. I didn't, but I knew some who did. And that's a more of a one-on-one relationship, teacher in class. And as I say, when it's well done, it can be really effective. But I took an indirect approach through the third attitude, which would be a mutual respect that I felt, and I expected my students to feel for the subject that I was teaching, that was English.
Mm-hmm.
And, as you know, I would record what I was reading, and then we'd read along with the recording, and that freed me to walk around the room to make sure that they were paying attention. It was also my belief that... A great tradition had been diluted over the years from my parents' generation through TV to mine, that is, reading together aloud.
Mm.
And you and I and your sister, of course, we went through at least a year of doing that.
We did that for a while, and that was torturous at times.
Yes.
And my sister just bailed. And then it became you and me, and then it became... me reading it and then reporting what I had read.
That's right.
And there was money involved. There was
oh, yeah, I paid you $1 a page.
And I learned that if I read all week, at the end of that week, I could get a G.I. Joe figure.
Sure. So that was your equivalent of an allowance. But your sister has never forgiven me for Billy Budd.
No, Billy Budd was not a good book for children.
Probably not.
It's very... You know, I read Moby Dick, and it's easier than Billy Budd.
Well, that's odd that you say that.
And Robinson Crusoe was tough, too. But I was very into the way he built his little fort island.
Good.
That interested me.
But I don't know what Robinson Crusoe you read. You may have read an updated version.
I read it in the Great Books. Do you remember that? That was the grand experiment. You got this encyclopedic program that reprinted public domain books. in a 30-volume set called The Great Books. And there was, I remember there was one on Voltaire, and there was, I can't even remember who was in there. It was kind of like a Reader's Digest of classical literature, well, but that, it was a bookcase full.
I'm not following you on that, but Billy Budd I chose because it's the one Melville story whose style is easy. It's almost not by Melville. The prose is simple. If you read Moby Dick again, mm-hmm. with this in mind, you'll find the prose there is deeply convoluted.
It digresses very quickly and Melville, in many different directions.
Ordinarily, it is not easy to read, but Billy Budd was, and yet that didn't go over well. I think that's what broke your sister's patience.
Yeah, I stayed with it. I stayed with it mostly for the money.
Sure. As I said, that was your allowance.
Yeah, but we did become a family of heavy readers. You know, my sister still reads.
I always put that down to the fact that there were books in the house on shelves. That's all. Later, of course, they went up into boxes in the attic. But
there were still books in the
still
walls on
the shelves.
It's just that there were more books in boxes in the
attic. That's right. So that was one point. And the other point is that occasionally we did read together out loud, whether it was systematic. I don't think it was ever natural or spontaneous. But that's a reflection of the days before television. Perhaps even of the days before radio. But going back to Dickens and the Victorians, that's what people did. We have this great new art form that we've been discussing, cable drama, Mad Men, The Wire, Deadwood, Rome.
Mm-hmm.
Great dramas.
I keep recommending Breaking Bad to you, but I know you're not very far into it.
Episodic in a sense, but not in the usual sense. You take the 42 minutes that you get in the typical commercial main channel dramas. They can be terrible just because of that form. But the fact that you're running a story without those constraints on cable TV has opened up a great new create. I'm convinced it has to be a brand new art form for the 21st century. But going back to the 19th, you would have people reading Dickens and George Eliot and George Meredith. And Dickens, in particular, was released, as you know, in magazine issues.
Right.
And they wouldn't know how it was going to end.
There'd just be chapters
I'm not
every
sure,
issue.
You'd have to check this out, but I'm not sure if Dickens knew at the beginning of a book how it would end.
Yeah, they were written in a way, the way that comic books are written.
Okay, that's
always
a very,
To be continued. Where
there you go.
If you want to, you can follow Spider-Man. If you want to believe it, you can say Spider-Man is this one story that began in 1961 and is going today.
Yep,
because it's always continued from where it was.
It was true of Superman too. Didn't they have a break or an attempted break? Did one of those characters die? It was
Superman, they killed Superman in the 90s.
Yeah.
And they kept the story going, and then they brought him back. And then 5 years ago, DC Comics just rebooted everything. They canceled everything and started everything with a new number one. Broke that line to try to entice a new audience. But then as they went into it, they started to realize, well, these stories are great. We shouldn't ignore these stories. Well, so we'll say they happened. So now it's a bit of a gray area.
Yeah, and that is, of course...
But even Arthur Conan Doyle did that. He killed off Sherlock Holmes and brought him back 10 years later.
And that's because he wanted to do something better.
Right.
That's hard to conceive because in his genre, there is nothing better.
Right, but there's always that... When someone's the best in their field, I'd say more often than not, they want to be in a higher field than that.
Yeah,
they want to see if they can just... top what they've done.
That higher field is my justification for reading. And oddly enough, it's my justification for collecting. If you abuse it, this natural ambition to be better, if you abuse this natural attempt to get on a higher level conceptually and intellectually and morally than the one you're on, if you abuse that and go past a sensible level then you could become a maniac or as an entire culture, you may just try to become God. And oddly enough, it's in the abuse of the urge to collect that you can see that. Not in the urge itself. If you, and I think we agree that, as you said, you use me as your cautionary example.
Yeah.
So let's use me then as the example of abuse of this desire, and we'll give you the credit of reining it in your own life. But what is it about wanting, you say, all the Batman issues from the year of your birth.
Right.
To today.
Yeah, which I am one issue away from owning.
And as you said, it's not expensive, that issue.
Right, so I'll get it soon.
There you go.
Maybe by the time this podcast comes out, I'll own it.
All right, now again, if you miss the point, and the point is a spiritual point, and it's at least it's an intellectual point, but it's an intellectual point before it's a spiritual point. And you then the question for the cynic would become, all right, now you've got that last issue that you wanted. So what? Now you've got a complete collection. Well, complete from the year of your birth.
Yeah, it's not so much so what is more of now what?
Well, no. Now what bypasses the question.
Okay.
The question is not now what, but so what? Mm-hmm. What? Why did you bother to do that? Now, I'm taking a cynical point of view, somebody outside the issue, and to make you feel more at ease, I'll apply the question to myself.
No, you can. Okay, you can. No. You're in this example. You can point the finger at me.
No, I'll point it to myself only because I'm aware of the items in the series. I wouldn't be in your case, of course, because that's not my field. But there's a game put out by GMT, a game series called Combat Commander. And it's got great reviews. I keep up with the reviews. It's supposedly a really good system. But what would I know, since I've never played it? But I have. I have all the issues, that you would say issues, mm-hmm. but all the games in the series. It might be close to 10, and yet have never played one of them. So that's an abuse of the idea. I'm trying to rectify the abuse. I can give it to people who really can use it and will use it. But it's a strange abuse, if you think of it. Your collection has at least the virtue that you've read these issues. How many issues in the Batman collection have you not read?
A few.
Why not?
Because I didn't have the issue after it. So I didn't want to start a story and have a chapter missing. So there's a few. I've read most of them, but then again, I'm counting anything I've read where I began reading Batman in, actually was when I had pneumonia in my sophomore year. I got The Dark Knight Returns, which I then lent to you. I read that while I was sick, and I ended up reading it 3 or 4 times because I was home all day. And then I don't know if you remember this, but I snuck out of the house while I had pneumonia so I could buy the new issue.
Now, you know, I didn't know that, and I'm really disappointed to hear that about you, Jonathan.
Well, luckily we're in my house.
That's right.
When this happened. Yeah, but I did. I snuck out with pneumonia and bought the latest Batman and the latest detective, and then I've been reading it steadily since 1988. So anything that's been published since then is already guaranteed. I don't have to sit through and read them again. But there are a few. But I think that goes back to what we were saying before about books that you've read that you don't remember reading.
That's right.
I think part of you wants to have that on the shelf because, well, I know this is great, and if I forget it, at least I can go back and I can revisit it.
That's right.
Because I can't rely on it, on having it in my own head.
Yep, absolutely. You want the physical or the hard copy or at worst, the virtual copy, whatever you need. You want something there as a guarantee or insurance that you can go back and fill in the spaces, however wild and weird they are in your memory. But this idea of a complete collection.
Right, one having way or the everything.
Other, I think that's the key. Now, we can set aside the issue of abuse, because those are in most cases obvious, but the temperate collector who keeps his ambition within bounds and, as we say, actually refers to the inside of the book or game, let's use him as the example and not the abuser.
Yeah, like when you go to someone's house and they show you their collection and it's one shelf of a few different eclectic books, you know, or a few DVDs, and you say, well, this is, and it's what they've written, but it doesn't have that depth of focus that a collector would have.
Right.
They don't have that need to have everything.
Yes, and that's the need I'm talking, and I'm going to try to defend it as not an unnatural or absurd desire. There's something about A and Z and all the issues in between that lead to the obvious feeling of satisfaction with completion itself. Another word for completion is perfect.
Right.
And that's what I think is fundamentally at work. You want a kind of perfection. You also want to be outside that perfection. So you're not any longer in the process of not knowing how it's going to end, not in the process of contributing to the development of it, but you're still participating in its completion. You're still participating in the perfection. And that word, participation, is itself the key theme to a whole school of philosophy, Platonic and Neoplatonic. That word participation goes back to, if not directly to Plato, it goes back to a Roman philosopher called Plotinus. Participation in what? In perfection. Now, this is the point at which maybe you should take a large scissors and cut the topic.
You can't do that with a digital file.
Oh, I see.
This goes back to the conversation we were having about cassette tapes before we began.
This is not on cassette?
No, I can't rewind this with a pen.
Oh, all right.
you don't see a boombox in between us.
There you go.
As you would have.
But I've said it, and I'll say it again.
All right, you can say it again. I'll cut it when you say it again, but you can say it again.
I knew that
people listening go, you already said that.
There's going to be some kind of editing involved here. But that's why collectors collect, because they want to participate in perfection.
Mm. Now, what happens to collectors who are collecting something ongoing? Because say let's use Batman as an example. Yeah. They're not going to stop publishing Batman anytime soon. So it'll never be complete, because every month there'll be another one. So you always have to keep coming back to do it. Whereas something like, say, the complete Shakespeare, obviously you can buy that in a one-volume edition, but you can have all that. No one's going to make more Shakespeare. No one's going to make more Ian Fleming novels. No one's going to make more Tolkien books. So is there something even more flawed in trying to collect something that's not going to end?
No,
it'll probably outlive you.
Just the opposite. Because when you actually complete the collection, then you are prone to that question. Not my question, so what? But your question, now what? There is a sense in which the completion of the project kills it. It's going to happen to a madman.
There's only about 8 episodes left.
Yeah. There's a real sense of loss. There's a kind of grieving process. I've been listening to the background interviews during some of these series. The Shield, for example.
Mm-hmm.
When a major character, let's say one of the 10 top characters, dies if you haven't watched the series.
You won't say who. I haven't watched this yet.
I'm not going to get any. The point is that the role, the character, is played by an actor who is, or may well have made personal friends with the rest of the cast. So that if a series runs 7 years, and it's kind of like the lethal equivalent of jumping the shark when you kill a character like that, the whole tenor of the series feels it.
Right.
And I've heard it said that when the character films, they have a party at the end of the season, but it's almost like a wake.
Yeah, well, from the production standpoint, when you kill off a character, you're firing the person who plays that character. So they don't come to work anymore.
No. And the series may go on, as I said, for a few years, and that character may be doing very well. Hopefully, that's the normal course of an actor's life. He leaves one role and goes to another.
Right.
So it's not really a grievous thing, but it does create a kind of grief. And here I'll go back to my argument that all good literature, whether it's great or just solidly good, and again, you can refer to your comic books. I could refer to the books I've read, but we can both refer to this new art form on cable TV. This is literature. This is really good stuff. All this stuff is a participation in something higher than the ordinary. It's a participation in something a little closer to perfection than we ordinarily get. And if you don't believe that, just start listening to the writing on shows like Mad Men and The Wire. Just some of these individual quips, or just a few occasional lines. I heard Wiener, the showrunner for Mad Men, say recently that they've had to worry about they were being too clever, that their lines in certain episodes were too good, that
they didn't sound like they were coming from people.
Yeah, that too. But they would also detract from the real emphasis of the show, which is telling a story.
Right.
I told you I had to go back to season 6.
Because you had dropped Mad Men for a while and came back.
Yeah, because I hadn't been watching it on AMC, and happy not to because of the commercials. Even if you play them back,
fast forward them.
You know, there's no subtitles. If you're a little hard of hearing, you want them. And you don't want to even fast forward through commercials. So if you're not, if you're retired and you don't have to worry about the what's that called? The water cooler conversation.
Right. Spoilers.
Yeah. So
you're not on the internet enough to get it from the internet.
No. So what you can do is just, if you don't have to binge watch it, but you could watch it a whole season of 13 episodes over the course of a week or two. So you get a much closer feel for the continuity. But you also have the time, again, with the subtitles, you can see how brilliant the writing is during the course of it.
Well, you're seeing it play out over several episodes. Because that show especially, they'll drop a seed of a tone of something that they won't pick up for a few episodes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a matter of cleverness. But this is something deeper than cleverness. This is something profound. And it goes back to being careful of not being too witty or too clever. You're really telling a story that has a profound message to it. Or at least in the higher examples, you're doing that. In Mad Men, I had given up because I'd lost the element of high drama. It was becoming too low and depressing, principally through the characters, what's been happening to them.
Right, and I think that was thematic because
season six was a slow spiral
that Don goes into until he hits rock bottom.
And that was part of it. He obviously is the focus of the show. And the alcoholism and the rampant, or rather, well, I guess rampant and rampaging infidelity to no point.
Right.
And then he has the affair, you remember, with the woman
in the building. Right.
But the point is, what makes Mad Men so superior isn't just the sparkling writing. It's not just the lines. It's the theme. And to have his daughter discover the affair in a typically pornographic posture, that just destroyed them. Destroyed all three of them.
Right.
And the fact that he could bring that to conclusion in one almost still scene at the end of the series, the season, where they're looking at the house, which is a whorehouse.
Yep.
And you're left to wonder, did he tell her what went on in that house? He brought her back to it, so...
He brought them all. He brought all three.
Yeah, but the little kids, but the daughter.
Yeah, but to be fair, the boys don't really have a character on that show.
So you don't know, and you don't have to know, you shouldn't know how much he told her. But you know, as the audience, that he's brought it... Now, that was... And because that follows, you remember the development that... I'm saying this, I know you're not familiar because we forget. And I've just seen it 2 or 3 weeks ago, so I remember. But you may forget that prior to that, Don does, at least what I interpreted as a really self-sacrificing thing. He gives the... who's Ted? Remember, Ted is
yeah.
Ted is going through the same thing that he's going, only... Ted's now at the incipient stage. He's going to destroy his family.
Right.
And he says he can't do it. And he has to get out of town. He has to go to the West Coast.
Yeah, he has to run away from Peggy.
We learn in season 7, it doesn't help. But Don looks at him, sees him going to do the same thing that he's already done. He knows how miserable he is. Ted's not an alcoholic, but he's going to do the same thing for the sake of illicit sex. He's going to destroy his family. And Don says, you go to the West Coast. Even though that destroys his marriage.
Right.
Because his wife had already gone to the West Coast, and now he's going to tell her he can't join her.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, he gets fired. The intricacies of plot are so natural. So at the end of the last couple of episodes, after what I saw Don do was so admirable. And again, this is ennobling. This is what we're looking for. We're looking in literature for ennobling.
Mm-hmm.
We want to get up to the high. And that's never done without morality. The highest field is almost defined by morality. Virtue. Mm-hmm. Moral virtue as well as intellectual virtue or artistic virtue.
And that's one of the things that makes Don so interesting is that he's not a gray character where he's neither good nor bad, but he does very, very good things and very, very bad things.
He does, but...
And it's all a matter of internally as an audience member, where do you set that balance to decide if he's a good or a bad person?
Yeah. Remember in season 7, he punches the minister.
Mm-hmm.
And, he meets the minister at the bar is trying to tell him to find Jesus.
Right.
So Don winds up in jail for punching him. Which I thought that was a great direct confrontation of...
I also loved in season 7 how he's humbled.
Yes.
And he thinks that if he accepts humility, he'll be saved. Like, no, we're just trying to beat you up so you'll go away.
But he is. He is saved by humility.
Right.
Because through his humbling, serving as a partner under Peggy now.
Right.
Because Peggy goes in season 7 on her own spiraling descent.
Mm-hmm.
But she saves
at the
end. Well,
she's Don's protege in almost every way.
Yeah, it's not drink, it's just...
Right, it's not philandering and it's not alcoholism, right. But still that toughness and that aggression.
Nastiness, yeah, nasty. Yeah. You know, it's not just that she's hard, Who's the other one? The other female lead?
Joan.
Joan is hard, but not really nasty.
Right.
But Peggy's hard and nasty.
Yeah.
And you can see that, especially with the argument she gets into with her secretary.
Mm-hmm.
And how she
The flowers on Valentine's
Day? Yeah. Yeah. That was just ridiculous. Petty, yeah. And she knew it. But she was just being needlessly mean, but yet necessarily mean given the way she was thinking. And it was Dawn who breaks her out of it. Mm-hmm. And that ends in the dance in the office mm-hmm. when she lays her head against his chest. And he kisses her on the top of the head. There's the father.
Right.
And his real daughter. There's the family.
Yeah.
The whole thing comes down to family at the end. That's why not only it's moral and realistic, but ennobling. Mm-hmm. When the dust is done and we're all done, what will we be most proud of having done?
That is a great place to end.
There you go. Family.
Well, and here we are doing a Father and Son podcast.
Gotcha.
But thank you for coming in. That's great. Thank you for flying to Chicago, number one. It's been...
Yeah, my ears are still popping.
It's been 4 years.
4 years.
And thank you for coming on the podcast. A lot of people have asked, yeah, your father sounds like an interesting guy, if I tell stories about you.
Well...
And now people have gotten a chance.
Good. I'm glad we put a pin in that bubble.
Well, no one can follow you on the internet. Do you still remember your blog? Have you updated your blog?
No. And who is my only fan?
Bill Monroe is your only follower. Bill Monroe. Who's on the show many times.
I may see him this weekend in
Poland. Oh, yeah. He'll be in town as well. And we're going to try to do another podcast this weekend with him. But you can follow me at Not In My Book on Twitter. And you can follow us on the Facebook page. As always, you can visit Chimera's Comics and see Steven at 19 South LaGrange Road in LaGrange, Illinois. We will talk to you next week.
Caffeinated Comics is a Not In My Book production.
Take that!